Welcome to the Fresh Lens podcast,
where we read books and discuss ideas that change the way we see the world.
I'm Trish Vino.
And I'm Hirad Motamed.
And we are your hosts.
Hey, Trish.
Hey, Hirad.
What are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about the platform that everybody loves to hate, Facebook. And they've managed to get themselves in the news even more than usual this week. So I think we're going to talk about a couple of the headlines and what we think about them.
I actually wanted to kind of talk about it more in broad strokes first, and then we can kind of go into the specific allegations or things that have come out now. So the general conversation around Facebook seems to revolve around two issues. One is it a monopoly? So this whole question of the monopoly power of big tech companies has been in the news over the last year, year and a half. And the second one is the social harm of these platforms, specifically with social media. And we talked about this a little bit in the context of the constitution of knowledge, but that was more geared towards the question of misinformation, not social harm in general.
This is just straight up bad for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of on the question of a monopoly, I think it's very... I think there's something in the air where people feel that these big tech companies have too much power, but we don't actually know what to do about them yet. So what governments are trying to do is essentially apply the antitrust thinking that we had from back in the industrial age and try to kind of force it on these tech companies like Facebook and Google, and completely missing the point that the dynamics of these companies are very much different, right? Mm-hmm. So when we were talking about a railroad monopoly, for example, we're talking about a company controlling the entire infrastructure such that if you want to get goods shipped from point A to point B, you absolutely have no other choice but to use the company that owns these tracks that go from A to B, where there are no other tracks that go from A to B, right?
And no other company could possibly erect their own set of tracks. Like, it would just be too much of a barrier to entry.
Right. And so the dynamic with tech, with internet companies is completely different. So, for example, with Google, you and I could easily type Bing.com into our browsers and go and do our searches on Bing, or you can make it your default search engine. In fact, any device you buy, when you open the browser, there is a setting where you can change your default search engine to something other than Google, right?
Yeah.
But we don't, because that's really the best. It's not that we don't have the choice. It's not that Google can stop us from making that choice, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that Google simply delivers the best result, and therefore we're more likely to use Google, which then leads to Google giving us the best results. So it has this virtuous cycle working for it, whereas the other ones kind of have less of that, right? And so it's the same with Facebook as well. A couple of days ago, Facebook had this massive outage that I think it's probably historic in how long it was and how many services it affected.
Did you notice it was down?
I didn't know. First thing in the morning, I noticed it was down.
Okay, so I'm not alone. That I have to admit that, yes, I also noticed first thing in the morning. Why does Facebook not work?
Well, I'm also in a long-distance relationship, so I realized that I have no relationship if Facebook is down. Like, my only means of connecting with my girlfriend while Facebook is down is through email. The next step below that, if Gmail went down, I'd have to start writing letters again, putting them in the mail.
So these antitrust laws, there seems to be some sort of argument that it's sort of the same argument as billionaires shouldn't exist, as once something gets so big, we just need to break them up just because they're too big. And so just to summarize what you were saying, the old metric of antitrust being there is no competition, you're a monopoly, and you're provided or you're erecting barriers to entry so that new firms that perhaps want to enter into free market competition can't. None of this seems to apply to Facebook at all.
So this is what I was going to get at with the outage that they had. Immediately, once people realized that Facebook is down, these other apps like Telegram or Signal shot up to the top of the download charts for the app stores for iOS and Android. So clearly there are alternatives that people use when these services are down. So on the one hand, they don't really have a monopoly on connecting people.
Right.
And the second thing to realize...
Or a monopoly on communication.
Or a monopoly on communication. And the second thing is what they're really in competition for is not competing against other social networks. What they're really in competition for, if you think about where Facebook makes its money, is time.
This is such an important point.
The more time you spend on Facebook, the more opportunities they have to serve advertisements to you, right? So the thing that is limiting them is not whether or not you are spending time on other social networks, is really spending time on anything other than Facebook or Instagram, right? So, or WhatsApp. So what they're really competing with is Netflix. They're competing with video games.
TikTok.
They're competing with TikTok. They're competing with news. Anytime that you take out your phone, imagine all the apps that you can open. Every time you don't open a Facebook app, that is a point of competition for Facebook, right? Yeah. And so this is one of the key things that's different about the internet than kind of if you think about this from the pre-internet lens, you're going to get it wrong, because this was a dynamic that's brought about with the mobile revolution. And prior to that, it didn't make any sense. Like for you to consume content, you had to be sitting on your sofa in front of a television.
Yeah.
And that's how you could do it. There was no sense of kind of just taking out your phone and checking things on a short interval, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Do you think that there's a good argument then to be made that Facebook is too big and it needs to be like disaggregated in some way?
From a monopoly or antitrust point of view, I don't think there's anything that holds water. Again, there are alternatives. We saw that with the outage. And there is also, like, if you think about some of the arguments that people are making in the context of the social harm that Facebook does. So one of the documents that was leaked, and we'll talk about more later, kind of around how Facebook is a toxic platform because they really prioritize engagement over all other things, over people's well-beings and over whether or not the content is toxic or whatever. And if you think about it, a company that is a monopoly, by definition, that means that people have nowhere else to go. They don't really have to fight for engagement because you don't really have a choice, right?
Yeah.
So these two arguments, only one of them can possibly be true, right?
Yeah.
Either Facebook is chasing engagement or Facebook is a monopoly, and the two of them can't be true at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's very weird to me to think that a business should, for some reason, try to be less good at business.
Right.
You know what I mean? That Facebook should know better, and it should like want you to be engaged, but not too engaged. And that there's some like ethereal magic balance that they have to figure out. Not you as a user, that the provider has to figure out.
Right. And so this is where we get to the second part, which is a lot of the people that are kind of beating this drum. On the one hand, they want the provider to figure that balance out. But on the other hand, they want them to figure it out in just the right way that they like it.
Yeah.
So if you listen to a lot of these legislators, the senators and the congresspeople that are talking about this as a problem, from their point of view, they're not actually talking about breaking up Facebook. They're talking about getting control over its content.
Reining it into the ideology that they sort of see as correct.
Well, yeah, exactly. This is the thing. Like Facebook has essentially become a single choke point for information flow by the virtue of the fact that it's such a huge global publisher. And there is kind of bipartisan support right now for trying to get it under control. The only question is whose control?
Yeah. And what will be deemed misinformation? Or, I mean, misinformation is a little easier because I think that it's something that's untrue, but I think that there is not to like overuse an analogy of like slippery slope. Is like some things are difficult to prove and some things are,
well, yeah, but I think we have already, so in the last year and a half, so prior to 2020, I would say Facebook held the line in trying to not be the arbiter of what is true and what people can or cannot see, right?
Yeah, to their credit.
To their credit, absolutely. Yeah. To Mark Zuckerberg's credit, he was trying to avoid taking on that role.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, with all the negative PR that they get, which is unfair in my opinion, and a lot of this public backlash and push from governments, they're more and more taking on that role and they're doing all these fact checks. But the fact checks are very regularly wrong. And when they are, especially if you think about things like in the context of the pandemic, where the information is from week to week, the information is very different. So when you kind of fact check something that later on turns out to be true, but you kind of censored it or you prevented it from being prominently shared, that is a very bad look that just feeds more into the negative PR that will then want the political party that was opposing that fact check to want to regulate you. And then you end up kind of swinging back and forth, right? Yeah. You censor something that like the Republicans may like, and the Republicans want to censor you or want to get you under control. And then you censor something that the Democrats may like, and then they want to get you under control. So it's a bit of a terrible cycle for Facebook to be in, but I think it's important to recognize that a lot of this conversation is unfair, and it's really kind of dunking on Facebook has become a bit of a cottage industry. There are people, mm-hmm. kind of celebrity critics that have made entire careers, yeah. out of just dunking on Facebook. And A, they rarely offer a solution. And where they do offer a solution, they refuse to acknowledge trade-offs with those solutions, yeah. right? So it's quite frustrating. I think the level of discourse on it is has been quite low.
Yeah.
And we also got to acknowledge that Facebook brings a lot of good in the world. But again, it is a tool. It's a tool for connecting people. And so it's going to have the good and the bad, but the good is also there.
Yeah. It's always silly to me when someone blames the medium or blames the platform for, like, we know that people have capacity for good and bad, and that it's messy and sticky, and you know, and so it's just like, obviously as something that's made up of people, it's going to be a little bit of a gong show.
Yeah, it was interesting to me too. There was a internal memo written by an executive back in 2016, I believe, and in it they kind of talk about how they have this imperative of connecting people, and we'll link to this in the show notes, but essentially the memo very clearly acknowledges that there's a good and the ugly about connecting people, right? Mm-hmm. So Facebook connects people, and this is kind of I'm paraphrasing the way the memo is written. They connect people, and it can be positive. Maybe someone finds love. Maybe someone who is on the brink of suicide gets saved. And so they connect more people. But it can also be negative. Maybe yeah. they end up connecting human traffickers, which is one of the things that has come out in the recent documents.
People get scammed out of money.
Exactly. People get scammed. Ultimately, Facebook is in the business of connecting people, and this is what this memo acknowledged. So it is kind of important to see that as this is the bias within which they operate, right? And if connecting people is a bad thing, then you can always count on Facebook to not see it that way, because you can't expect someone to understand something when their paycheck depends on them not understanding it, right? But having said that, the question is, can you make the decision of when connecting people is a good or a bad thing? I think connecting people is actually more of an inevitability of the internet. And Facebook has so successfully executed on its mission, which I think was an inevitability of the internet. Somebody was going to do this, right? And Facebook has done it so successfully that they have become synonymous with the good of the internet and the bad of the internet.
Yeah.
And it becomes the single punching bag for all of the harm that this cheap, instant connection network that we built has brought.
It's so human for us to want to, like, push all the bad that's innately in us and just put it on the platform.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, so one of the things that came out of this whistleblower's documents was this internal research that talked about acknowledged how teenage girls were harmed by using Instagram, more or less. But my question about this is, you know, we've had this conversation since the 90s about those glossy magazines with airbrush models on yeah. them and what effect they have on the teenage girls.
Yeah.
But like we talked about this in the previous episode, the old distribution model for information, whether it was news, whether it was magazines or whatever it may have been, you had to get physical copies of something printed and get it on shelves, right? And so a few companies would do that very well, and they had reach. Nobody else had reach because it was an expensive thing. So it was very difficult to have a single publisher that can put its magazines on every shelf on every part of the world instantaneously on a daily basis or an hourly basis, mm-hmm. right? Something like that just did not exist. The internet has essentially made this distribution completely free, and Facebook has done it very successfully, where they have become the biggest publisher on the internet.
Yeah.
Where they can just distribute content everywhere in the world to 2.8 billion people instantaneously, yeah. right? And so I think the dynamic that we're talking about with how teenage girls consume Instagram is exactly the same thing as what we were talking about in the 90s with those glossy magazines. The difference is now there's a single worldwide publisher that you can use as the punching bag that you didn't have before, right? You may have had multiple magazines and they might have been pushing some kind of unhealthy image in, I don't know, well, Asia and another one in North America.
I would say that it's worse than the glossy magazines, right? Like when you're a kid and you're looking at the glossy magazines, I think that there's a certain level of, well, they are a supermodel. And, you know, in order to succeed in modeling, you had to like jump through all these hoops and sort of be like the prettiest of the prettiest. Whereas with Instagram and filters and what we're able to do with technology now, it's like anyone can kind of make themselves look pretty yeah. friggin' good. And I think that that's the problem, is you're kind of seeing like, it's no longer, oh, I know intellectually that supermodels exist. There's this class of really attractive people. It's sort of feeling like the people that you're competing with directly in your community.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there is this sense of closeness.
So it's definitely yeah. worth, because like yeah. you're not like the average person isn't competing with a supermodel, yeah. right? Like yeah. you're competing with your peer group, and so I think it is worse.
Yeah,
having to like constantly consume that your peer group, you're falling behind in your peer group, or you might be.
Yeah, that's the part I don't have a good grasp on, is whether people generally perceive those who are on Instagram as their peer group versus kind of people that they put on a pedestal and are viewed as special somehow.
I think that
right?
there's like a mix. It'd be celebrities, but this is the other thing with Instagram. It's like, if you're going to be scrolling, you can scroll by Kylie Jenner and then you can scroll by your friend, you know?
Right.
It's all just kind of there in the same mix.
Yeah.
So they're probably getting, I mean, I don't know what a 14-year-old girl's Instagram feed looks like yeah. these days, but I'm assuming it's a mix of all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So.
But then the other thing to me is, where is the sense of kind of personal, or in this case parental, responsibility, right? Again, with any kind of information that, or anything that children do, you know, it could even be like as simple as going to the street, right? There has to be some level of parental supervision, right? We can't expect Mark Zuckerberg to be making these decisions of, again, who gets to see what. I remember like when I was a kid, I had family friends who were around my age, and their parents allowed them to drink from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And my parents never allowed me to drink, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, different families and different people will make different choices for their children. And also part of it depends on you knowing your children as well, right?
Yeah. On one hand, I totally agree with you that the parents have to be the parents. I don't feel like you need to have Mark Zuckerberg be their parent or the government try and be their parent. Ultimately, you're responsible for your kids, and I think that that's where that lies. But because we sort of let the genie out of the bottle now, every 14-year-old kid has a smartphone. Probably every 14-year-old kid has some form of social media. So we're starting to realize that this thing's bad for them. If you're a concerned parent and you just yank your kid, you know, off the internet, you're really like isolating them. And so I think that there is this feeling amongst parents where they're like, I know this is bad for my kid, but this is also kind of their whole life, and this is how they communicate and are, you know, engage in sociality. Like, how you can't just all of a sudden like flip the switch on this and be like, and now you're going to be isolated.
You don't have to. It's not a question of like black and white question of whether you flip the switch on or off, but it is a question of guidance, right? Your kids can be consuming a lot of negative content. I mean, like, this is, again, different parents make different choices about this, but when I was growing up, it was a question of violent movies, right? At what point can you watch violent movies? It wasn't a question of you don't get to watch movies.
And to push back with that, because this was a thing with the 90s, is the violent video games leading to like people shooting up their schools and stuff, and the data seems to show not for those things.
Right, but that's not what it's about, though. It's a question of what are parents going to allow their children to do or not, right? And there's some level of discretion that they can exercise.
Right. But it's almost like once your kid has already seen all the violent movies, being like, well, what do I do now? I'm just not going to let them see anymore going forward. Does that solve it?
Well, no, but I'm saying that it's not a question of whether or not you're going to watch movies or not watch movies. It's
right.
a question of you're going to exercise discretion on a movie-by-movie basis, right?
Okay.
And for various reasons, whatever your values are, you may not let your kid watch some movies, but you may want to let them watch another one. Or you may let them watch another one, but then you're going to provide some additional context for them to be able to, like, digest it properly.
When was the last time you interacted with a 14-year-old?
I don't know.
So granted, I don't hang out with any 14-year-olds, but I remember what it was like to be 14. And I feel like we're perhaps oversimplifying how difficult it is to guide a 14-year-old. And when they have this device and it's theirs and it's in their pocket all day, sort of like police what they can do with it. I don't know what the answer is. I just understand how we now have ourselves in this quandary.
Well, but it's not obvious to me that the answer would be, again, either Facebook or some government regulator stating what kids can see or not see.
No, I think that, and it's so funny that I'm going to say this because the libertarian in me, this goes against everything that I think, but I think that in hindsight being 2020, knowing what we know now, when COPPA, the Child Online Protection and Privacy, dropped the age to 13 to where you can sign up for something and not have parental consent, like, I think that that's really where we messed up.
Right. So this was an American law that said it restricted what internet services could do with children's information below 18, was it?
I think so. And then I believe it was dropped to 16 and then it was dropped to 13.
Right. And that would be kind of an interesting thing to get into about why that change happened. I mean, it would really have been a negative thing if, let's say, I'm just making this up, if it was media companies that were pushing, lobbying for that change to happen.
Yeah.
But it is ultimately, I think that would be a more valid way of trying to deal with this, is saying, like, you need to be a certain age to be able to do this, rather than we want Facebook to change its product in such and such a way and, like, do this kind of, use this kind of an algorithm. You know, I would actually be more okay with the hammer coming down and saying, like, no one below 18, once you're an adult and you can make your decisions, then you're...
Me too, because I think that putting the onus on parents to go against... I mean, Facebook and Instagram, they've got it figured out. How is a parent supposed to compete with a million little dopamine hits a day? I kind of feel like this is like that. That's a tough thing to be like, you're the parent, you've got to figure it out. Yeah. That to me doesn't seem... It seems a little bit like blame shifting, even though... Typically, I am really in the people need to take some personal responsibility camp. This is a rare exception for me. Is there anything else you would like to add about the evil empire?
No, I think Facebook has become a very convenient scapegoat for kind of social ills, which I think is very unfair characterization. I think they enable people to connect, and a lot of good things and bad things come with that. But I think where we're kind of heading right now in the public discussion, I mean, with a lot of the things that this whistleblower has brought forward, they're not really new information. It kind of repeats the same narrative about Facebook that has been out for a long time.
Well, I think that this is kind of why it resonates so much, is because, like, everyone kind of intrinsically knows that that social media has a bad side, that it often feels bad. Everyone can connect with this idea.
Yeah, but I think also a lot of it is based on, again, misinformation. I think one of the things I'm still seeing people reference was the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And Cambridge Analytica was essentially a scam that was sold to a bunch of political campaigns. It actually achieved nothing. And the fuss around it at the time was completely misguided because it didn't actually have the power to do what it claimed it could do.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that wasn't the whole lot of a nothing burger. But people are still referencing that as, like, an example of how Facebook is evil or is selling your data. And actually, the one big tech company that I use a lot and who I think should really be the target of some legal scrutiny is Apple. And Apple has actually ran ads talking about how Facebook sells your data, and it's completely wrong. It's a lie. They don't sell your data. They actually aggregate your data in a way that is not human understandable at all, and they would never want to give it away because that's actually the most valuable asset that they have that they can use to serve you ads, right? They don't sell your data because of that. It's just a bit of a false narrative that has gone out there. So I think a lot of the negative feeling towards Facebook has just been really misguided. I think Facebook enables businesses that could have never existed otherwise It connects people in a way that could have never happened without them. But again, Facebook is a very successful embodiment of like internet values, right? Mm-hmm. It connects people. Everything is instant. Everything is free. And what that means, though, is that they also become the punching bag for all the downsides of the internet, where the internet connects people, which means human traffickers can also use it to connect and communicate and coordinate to do whatever they want to do, right? And it's for an evil ends, mm-hmm. but the internet enables that, and Facebook is the embodiment of that. I don't think with the absence of Facebook or Mark Zuckerberg, we were going to have the absence of the internet being used for human trafficking.
Nefarious things.
For nefarious things, right. And so I think in a lot of the public discourse, the positive things that Facebook brings to the table are completely dismissed.
Yeah.
And a lot of really incorrect assumptions about what they do have been amplified. And again, yeah, I think that this is a bit of a tired discussion where a bunch of people have made a career out of dunking on Facebook, but never acknowledging that there are, for any action that they would take, there are real consequences on the other side of it, right?
Yeah. Well said. Thank you.
You want to talk about the cell tower?
Well, I think when I just talk about something being, you know, a tool being able to be used for good and for bad, it just reminded me, I had a friend who did a couple tours in Afghanistan when the war was on there. And, you know, the Taliban was always trying to blow up everything that the Americans were doing, and the Americans were always blowing up everything that the Taliban was doing. It was a war. But the one thing that never got blown up was the cell phone towers, and that's because the Taliban used the cell phone towers and the Americans were using the cell phone towers. So in what would often be, you know, a war-torn wasteland, the one thing that always survived was the cell phone towers. And so I don't think that, you know, it would ever be appropriate to make the argument that we need to get rid of cell phones in Afghanistan because the Taliban is using these to coordinate their attacks. It's a tool, and you obviously fight evil, but you don't necessarily blame the tools that are going to be there.
Yeah.
You just figure out how to also employ that tool in the fight for good and justice.
Yeah, yeah. So that's it. Mark Zuckerberg is a cell phone tower. Leave him alone. Listeners, that's a wrap. Thank you for listening.
We always appreciate your support. Please subscribe or follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you happen to listen to podcasts.
If you use Twitter, follow us there at FreshLensPod.
Finally, we always love to hear your feedback. Our email address is hello@freshlenspodcast.com.